Support for the Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. I could not be more excited. This is one of the most fun morning shows of the whole year, at least for me, and I think for you, our listeners, as well. We have gathered in the studio six nationally syndicated cartoonists and or illustrators of one stripe or another who have all come to town for the fifth annual Kenosha Festival of Cartooning, the brilliant brainchild of John and Ann Morse Hembrock. And this is always an exciting adventure to try to get to hear from each and every one of these talented men and women. So they are in town here for the next several days for a host of different events. And just about all of them, maybe all of them, are actually free and open to the public. And we will spell out the schedule before the hour is done. But let me introduce everybody who's here. And everybody is sitting out of order, in a sense. So I'm going to do the very best I can to figure out who's who. This is Mark Anderson.
Yes.
Mark Anderson has sort of a brand of cartoons, which he calls Andertoons. And they have appeared in all kinds of different magazines, including Good Housekeeping, Forbes, The Wall Street Journal. And he has some very interesting features on his own website that we're going to be talking about. We welcome Mark Anderson.
Glad you're
here. Right next to him is somebody I can identify. No, you don't even have to raise your name tag, because this is Jan Elliott, the one woman in the group. And Jan Elliott is responsible for the absolutely wonderful comic strip Stone Soup, which has been around for about 20 years, I think. In fact, this is the actual anniversary, isn't it, of Stone Soup?
In November. It'll be
very good. Great to have you here, and thank you for being a woman. So there's one person I just look at, and I know exactly
welcome.
Who you
Works
are.
For me, too.
Oh, dear. Oh, okay. Yes, right. Bill Morrison. Sorry. Bill Morrison. I am so excited to.
Yeah. Raise his name tag.
Right. Yes, he did. No offense. Bill Morrison has a really interesting resume that makes me real excited to talk to him. He actually has background as a technical illustrator before moving into different fields, including movie posters, The Simpsons, Bongo Comics. He's been involved in a lot of different facets of this industry. So welcome, Bill. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
Next to you is Darren Bell, who is responsible for the very intriguing comic strip Canderville, which is one of the relatively few comic strips, in a sense, set in the inner city. And we're going to be talking about the very interesting world he's carved out there, and also in another comic strip of his called Rudy Park. He also does some editorial cartooning and some storyboard work, so a very versatile artist as well. Darren Bell, we welcome you.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. Ed Steckley, I'm excited to be speaking about. He is someone who actually hails originally from Racine, so right up the road where I live. And so it's fun to connect with Ed, who is back in home territory. And in fact, once the festival is over, we'll be staying on for a couple of days to go to his alma mater of Park High School and a couple other places. And Ed Steckley is someone who's a wide-ranging career as an illustrator has also included work for Mad Magazine, a dream come true for him, lots of work in advertising. He's been an active part of USO tours and has a children's book coming out in the near future that he's really excited to tell us about. So, Ed Steckley, we welcome you home and welcome you to the morning show today.
Thank you very much.
And last but not least is Mark Tatuli. I should have made sure I asked how that name's pronounced.
You got it right. Pretty good.
Yay, Mark Tatuli. He's responsible for the comic strip Leo, which is an uncommon sort of comic strip in that it is a pantomime strip. Most of the time, you never hear, so to speak, a word spoken by the character of Leo or his father, nor spoken by anybody else. Once in a while, there'll be words written maybe on a box or something, but generally speaking, it is a wordless cartoon, which, of course, presents all kinds of challenges, but also makes it sort of in a sense, universally appealing. And he's also responsible for the comic strip Heart of the City. So, Mark Tituli, we welcome you as well.
Thank you.
Good to have all of you here. So, now you two need to share. So, when it's time for you to talk, just grab that mic, put it right in front of you. So, all right. Very good. Glad to have all of you here. Let's go right around the room and hear from each of you the probably the most basic question and one I'm sure you're tired of answering by now. But nevertheless, let's find out how it started for you. That is your own interest in artwork, and at what point it became something more than just sort of a passing fancy, or rather something you wanted to pursue with some real determination. So he's to the far left, and he's also alphabetically first, Mark Anderson, responsible for Andertoons. When did you first become interested in art?
Oh, I always loved cartoons, especially. I would, as soon as the Sunday paper came, I would grab it out of the paper and go read that, and I had a little light tracing desk that my mom got me, and I would trace Peanuts and Spider-Man and everything that I could get my hands on. And I just always loved to do that. But you never think, like, one day this is going to be your job.
So, well, or for you to create something versus recreating what somebody else has already created.
Yeah. And then I, like, did it for my high school paper and my college paper. And then later on, I just, like, you know what? I should give this a try. And I started sending them out, and people started buying them. And I was like, holy moly. Did not see that coming.
So did you almost immediately decide, then, this is how I want to make my living?
Yeah. I mean, once people start paying you for it, you're like, oh, I gotta run with this.
Not going to dig ditches anymore.
If people are paying me for this, I should do this.
Very, very good. Well, I'm excited to talk with you about all the different things that you're involved in. Jan Elliott, my recollection is you are very much a self-taught cartoonist or self-taught artist. So maybe the story of how this began for you is maybe a little different from others in the field.
Well, yes and no. I studied art in high school. My mom hired an art teacher for me, which was an unusual great gift at the time.
Wow. An art tutor almost?
Yeah, like an art tutor. And I went to college and was an art major for 1 year. And then, like many wild children of the 60s, I found myself pregnant and getting married. So I dropped out of school for a while, ended up going back and finishing my degree in English and Women's Studies. And then falling into cartooning when someone told me they thought I was funny. And I couldn't afford expensive art supplies, but cartooning art supplies are quite cheap, so paper and pen. And I, at that point, was divorced, had two children, and no money, and therefore a lot to write about. So I started doing cartoons about my rather pathetic life, and amazingly got them published almost immediately in an alternative newspaper, which gave me an incredible amount of naive hope that I would be able to make a living at this. So I immediately jumped to the conclusion that I would get syndicated, and I did get syndicated, but it took 16 years. So
wow.
I did a lot of advertising work, graphic work. I drove a bookmobile and sold cars in that time. So
wow. Yeah. So you didn't know enough to know just how crazy a dream it was.
It was really good. I didn't know enough to know how insane it was, yeah.
Very good. Well, we're glad you stuck to it and went for it, and the result, of course, is history. Right next to you is Bill Morrison, whose resume includes work with The Simpsons and Bongo Comics and so on, and also work as a technical illustrator. I think initially that's what you did.
Right.
So,
which is essential for becoming a cartoonist.
I see. Anyone who doesn't do that, they're up the wrong tree. So where did drawing begin? And from the start, was that the kind of drawing you were interested in? That is the more sort of technical stuff?
No. I grew up in Detroit, so that was, once I graduated from art school, that was sort of the only option available at the time. But it really started with my older sister. I have a sister who's 11 years older than me, so when I was about 3... she sat me down at the kitchen table, and she drew a stick figure. And she said, I want you to imitate what I just did. Here's a pencil, and I'm going to go do something. I'll be back in 10 minutes, and I want to see how you did. So I looked at her drawing, and I thought, I think I can do better. I noticed things were missing. You know, it was just a basic stick figure. And I'm like, well, it should have fingers, and it shouldn't just be the body shouldn't just be a stick. It should have width and... I think I had the arms coming out from the middle of the body, so I didn't really get the concept of shoulders yet. But, you know, she was probably 14, and, you know, I was a project for her, you know. We came from a big family, so I think, you know, she sort of focused a lot of attention on me. And when she saw this drawing ability, she just flipped out. And I remember that it left a big impression on me, because my older sister was saying, you're going to be an artist someday. And I just believed it, you mm-hmm. know. And I think that affected the rest of my life growing up, because people would say, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I would always say, well, I'm going to be an artist, because in my mind I'm thinking my big sister told me I was.
So and she knows everything.
Yeah, so I think a lot of kids have drawing ability. And if they get encouraged like I did, I think it gets fostered and they you know, it develops, and sometimes they make a career out of it.
Huh, that's a great story. I like that. Next to you is Darren Bell, responsible for two different comic strips, Canderville and Rudy Park. Darren, where did drawing become a big part of your life?
Well, from the moment I discovered my mom's paints. She's an artist herself. She was never published. She went into teaching, but she always, you know, in the back of her mind, wished she had been an artist. So when she discovered I was interested in it, she, you know, let me destroy all her materials by painting on the walls. And we rented, so she had to constantly paint over what I did when our landlord came to visit. So after a while, she bought me some paper, and I started drawing cartoons. And, you know, went off to school. I used to draw cartoons when the teachers were talking, and I'd pass them around class. And, you know, I went to a elementary school reunion a few years ago, and a lot of the people actually kept the cartoons that I drew back then.
From that many years ago?
Yeah. I mean, I saw back in elementary school how much people loved looking at simple drawings. So I always thought that's what I wanted to do. In high school, I changed my mind. I thought I'd get into journalism, because I used to watch the weekend shows, and everybody on TV looked really rich, like Pat Buchanan, all those people. They looked happy, rich.
I mean, the people on Meet the Press, things like that.
All those people, yeah. Okay. They were wearing ties, and that was interesting. So I thought, I want to be that when I grow up. So I became the editor-in-chief of the paper, and it turned out we didn't have enough articles to fill all the space, so I ended up filling them with cartoons. Mm-hmm. And I wrote 4 or 5 articles per issue. Nobody read them, but everybody read the cartoons.
Wow.
So, you know, so I was hooked.
The power of the picture.
Yeah.
Were you studying art in college? Or?
No, I never studied art. I was just, my mom taught me when I was a kid, and you know, I've just been drawing ever since.
There you go. So Jan is self-taught, your mom taught, and Bill is sister taught. Very good. Let's go this way, and actually let's, not that I don't think Darren knows how to share, but let's, I think it might be simpler to spin this mic back and forth.
Uh-huh.
So this is our Racine native, Ed Steckley.
Hi.
Ed, how did things begin for you?
I was never smart enough to do anything else but draw, so I did a lot of drawing growing up, and that never really ended. I was just a kid that would read Mad magazine. I ended up copying a lot of drawings from Mad just to pass the time. I just always enjoyed drawing. Yeah, that's it. My story is very, very boring compared to these guys.
Never rescued a kitten from a burning dog.
I do have a funny story about my first published job. I did the cartoons in the high school paper at Park High. But when I went to Whitewater, I went to go draw for an alternative newspaper on campus, because the main paper, which had been there for years, was very on the opposite side of the spectrum politically from where I was and where the people who were starting up this new alternate newspaper were. And we used to play pranks on the editor of the other paper and steal his nameplate from his office desk door. This is the guy that would come to school with a briefcase. And so we did a lot of razzing back and forth. Ours was in fun, but this guy would slam us in his paper, and we didn't have a sense of humor about it. And it was just kind of a fun. That went on for a couple years with this little rivalry. And a couple years ago, I opened up Time magazine, and I see this guy is profiled in Time. His name is Reince Priebus.
Wow.
He's the chairman of the Republican convention.
Wow.
And that was our rival in Whitewater because I went to school with him. So the guy who opened up this, who started up this alternative paper, still has a couple of the nameplates that he stole from the door. And I think if Ryan's, because Ryan's listens to this show,
yeah, right.
And so now he's finally going to know who stole all of his nameplates.
Oh,
are you sure it wasn't a different Ranks Priebus?
No, it was the one.
The one.
Never forget him.
Oh, very good. That is a good story. You were correct.
Thank you very much. I made that all up.
And finally, Mark Tatuli, responsible for the comic strips, Heart of the City and Leo. When did things begin for you artistically?
Oh, boy.
I'm waiting for that to happen.
Thank you. Thank you, Ed Steckley. I loved Disney cartoons growing up. I used to go to the movies and see Disney, and I loved cartooning always, but Disney showed me something different. I mean, I grew up on Bugs Bunny cartoons, too, but I went to see a Disney movie, and I realized that cartoons could be really funny, but they could also really strike a deep emotional chord, and you can create real characters that people can connect to. And that was always fascinating to me about creating my own world. And ever since I saw Disney cartoons, I was fascinated about creating my own world and characters that people really cared about. And could be funny too, because that's all I knew how to do was funny drawings. I tried to draw realistically, and then it always went south, and became very Dr. Seussian along the way. And that's just where my head went. And and of course Mad Magazine, as Ed mentions, a huge influence. So I'd say Leo was probably a combination of Disney cartoons and Mad Magazine kind of combined. I like those two kind of worlds, and I like to bring them together. And that's it. Those are the two big things, big influences for me.
I've been thinking a lot about Walt Disney because I just recorded an interview or broadcast an interview with the director of a new American Experience documentary that just aired about Walt Disney. Amazing film. And one of the most interesting moments in that film is when they talk about Bambi and that iconic moment where Bambi's mother is shot by the hunter. And a couple of the analysts say, I mean, it was extraordinary, probably the first time in human history that a drawing or series of drawings, which is what animation is, actually drove adults to cry. I mean, to have that kind of depth of emotional connection with something that you know is just drawings on a screen.
But all the Disney movies were like that. They always had these amazing emotional moments.
Yeah.
You know, Sleeping Beauty, when the witch turns into the dragon, is incredibly frightening. You know, it's just this amazing, and the colors in that are just amazing to me too. And I used to go to the movies because when I got to a certain age, kids my age looked down on Disney cartoons because, oh, that's for babies. So I'd have to sneak off and go by myself on my bike. And then, you know, during Lady and the Tramp, not let anybody see me crying. You know, but...
Tough guy.
No, never a tough guy. But, I mean, all the Disney movies are like that, you know, had those really, really deep emotional moments.
Cool. Well, I'm glad to hear such an array of different stories here about where kind of all of this started from. And I'm really glad, too, that we have a nice, interesting mix of artists in the room. And just for the sake of anybody just joining us, we have six guests in the room today, in the studio today. Six nationally syndicated artists who are here in town for the 5th Annual Kenosha Festival of Cartooning. And before the hour is done, we will spell out all of the events going on, which are going to keep these folks very, very busy for the next several days. And all of the events that are part of this are free and open to the public. So it's an absolutely stupendous opportunity to meet some of these artists and find out more about what makes them tick and more about the ins and outs of the careers which they enjoy. Several in the room are comic strip artists, and we're going to focus on that for just a moment. And let's start with Jan Elliott, not ladies first. It's just you're right here, and I want to talk about your comic strip called Stone Soup. Do I remember correctly that it actually started out as something else a few years earlier than that and then became Stone Soup?
Yes, it was a weekly feature in my local paper, and it was called Sister City.
Okay.
And name Sister City was the only thing that the syndicate wanted to change about the strip when they bought it because it had apparently tested as too ardently feminist in the South.
Okay.
This is what they told me.
It raised alarm bells among
us. I don't know, you know. So
tell us about the name Stone Soup.
Well, you know, they didn't like the name, so I had to think of something else. And I grew up with a mom who was a miracle worker with an empty refrigerator. And she was really good at making these casseroles that she referred to as Stone Soup because there was a little of this and a little of that in it. And you weren't allowed to ask what exactly. And it was all covered up by mushroom soup. And but when we were talking about it, and I mentioned that, my youngest daughter kind of jumped up and said, you've got to call the strip that. And so it kind of fits what a family is like. You know, a family succeeds because everybody helps out. There's a little from here, a little from there. And for me, as a divorced working mom, I couldn't have made it if I hadn't had, for a while, a child care subsidy. For a while, I had food stamps. My friends helped. My parents helped me a little. So, you know, and, of course, the kids do their part. So it just fit the whole family thing.
And, of course, that's very much a reflection of what the comic strip is about, particularly in the early going.
Yeah.
With this woman named Val, who is but she's a widow.
She's a widow, yeah.
Right. Tell us, first of all, about the fashioning a character who was in some ways a reflection of you and then obviously not entirely you. And what is that like to create something that feels like you to some extent and let you obviously don't want to make this the Jan Elliott show?
Well, and Joan, in a way, was divorced. Her sister, Joan, was divorced. Ah. And the two of them sharing a house actually was a reflection of me because I shared a house with another single mom. And just for the economic purpose of it all, the savings. And that single mom had a little boy, so I gave Joan little Max. You really, especially in the beginning, it's so autobiographical. You're writing maybe not about the exact thing that's going on, but all the emotion that comes from it. And when you're writing about the frustrations of not having enough money or time or, you know, just how stretched you can feel as a young parent, it does come right out of life. But, you know, then you want it to be bigger than you. So you give them. And it doesn't take long before the characters themselves go way beyond your control. And they have their own agenda. And you can't make them do certain things. Or you can't help them from doing certain things.
Right. One of the best things about the strip is that the two daughters are painted so vividly and very different from each other. Tell us about that matter.
They're oil and water, pretty much. Right. Yeah, they're totally different, as were my daughters. I have two daughters, and they could not be more different. There's an artsy one and a scientific one, and there was a lot of squabbling when they were little. And, you know, I had this friend who had also had two kids, and her most favorite thing she ever said to me when we would be driving in the car and all the kids would be fighting, she'd look at me, and she was from Oklahoma, and she'd say, well, we could beat them, or we could pull over and give them all a Snickers bar. And we'll do that. it's like adversity, but it gives you humor. It lightens up life. And then I discovered that the people I was writing for were grateful, you know, other moms and dads, whose lives, it's hard to get kids out the door in the morning to school and, you know, you ran out of milk and whatever. And people get impatient and angry and they don't want to. And if you can laugh about those kinds of things, it makes everybody happy.
Wow. Well, you're doing a great service for single moms everywhere and the rest of us who enjoy Stone Soup. And we should make sure that we mention the fact that something fairly momentous happened earlier this year.
Well, yeah, after 20 years of the strip being based on, a single mom, I married off Joan because Wally moved in next door and I just couldn't keep them apart. I just could not. They just refused. So they were made for each other. But I refused to ever get to marry Val off. But then, you know, momentum happens and this motorcycle cop she's been dating on and off for a long time. It's just like, well, okay, I'll let that happen. So now the premise of the strip is slightly different because now both of the sisters are married. But now you have the whole blended family thing.
Sure.
Got a guy who's never had kids learning to be a stepdad. Not that that ever happened in my life. yes, it did. it evolves. I mean, my characters don't age, but you just can't prevent them from changing over time.
Right.
Otherwise, I think it would just get boring. So.
Well, one would think so. And yeah. And yet, of course, there are certain comic strip artists who make a different choice, and things seem to be frozen in time, and it doesn't seem to be a creative issue for them. But I think probably most of us can really identify with what you're saying.
Yeah, they grow and change. So it's fun. I like it. They're very real to me.
Well, so do a lot of other people, that is, like Stone Soup and the characters you've created. Let's talk about Canderville with Darren Bell. And that's one of actually two comic strips you have.
Right.
Just say a quick word about what it's like to juggle two balls in the air, to keep two comic strips going. What kind of a challenge does that pose?
Not much of a challenge. Both comic strips exist in the same universe. They're just in different cities. One of them is set in a big city. The other is set in sort of a rural / suburban outskirts of that big city. So it has sort of the same sensibility. Rudy Park is a little more silly, more outlandish things happen in it that Rudy Park's
lighthearted also.
Lighthearted, yeah. And there are aliens, Atlantis exists in it, and I don't really touch on that stuff in Canderville. Canderville, I touch on more serious issues.
Right. It certainly has a grit, and for people who haven't seen Canderville, it's basically an inner city comic strip, and as far as I know, there isn't another comic strip like it. I mean, I can't think of one anyway that has that kind of a setting. What drew you to that possibility?
I didn't consciously set out to do that. I was just drawing my life. I was just drawing where I grew up and where I lived, and you know, and I was drawing what I was interested in. Like I was a child of the 70s and 80s. I grew up watching Good Times and other shows set in the big city, and to me that's, you know, two thirds of the country lives in the city today. Mm. It's where we are, so that's what I draw.
Right, you take on sort of the grit of the inner city and some very substantive issues to the point where I suspect Canderville's one of those cartoons that comic strips that end up once in a while on the editorial page rather than the comic strip.
Sometimes, or they end up in the trash can. Thrown
across the room.
Yeah, because it touches on things that a lot of people don't want to think about.
Right. I'm very intrigued about your main character, Lamont Brown, and there are probably a couple of ways in which he's at least a little bit of a reflection of you. For our listeners who maybe haven't seen Canderville, describe Lamont Brown and how you have put him together.
He's someone who wants to be heard. He wants to make a difference in the world, and the way he does that is through writing. He's a journalist. He also unexpectedly had life threw him a curveball. It gave him a son that he wasn't expecting. So he's juggling that he's juggling this personal responsibility with a responsibility to the world. And he also feels this duty to bring along with him a childhood friend named Clyde, who most people write off as a thug, as a worthless individual. Lamont doesn't want to leave him behind because he's part of the world. He's part of Lamont's world. He's not going to ignore him. He's not going to pretend he doesn't exist. No matter how many, some readers want me to. Some readers write and say, you shouldn't show us in a negative light, and I write back and I say, well, I'm also showing us in a positive light. You're only choosing to see the negative.
Right.
Maybe you should think about where the problem really is. Is it in what I'm showing or what you're perceiving? Lamont is just a well-rounded, real person with all the anxieties and fears that I have, with all the hopes and aspirations that I have. And I don't consciously sit down and think how is he going to be viewed or what message is he sending. I just try to write him as a real person.
Mm. Now, I know that you also do some editorial cartooning. Mm-hmm. When you feel like you have something that you want to say about Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or whatever or whoever. What sort of guides you in whether or not you're going to say that in Canderville versus saying it in an editorial cartoon? Which of those two canvases ends up being the one you turn to when, in a sense, you have a statement to make or a point to make?
Well, if it has anything at all to do with my characters or the themes of Canderville, it's going to end up in Canderville, whether I do it in the editorial cartoon or not. The only thing I think about is I don't ever want to tell the same joke twice. So whatever I do in the editorial, I have to take a different angle in the comic strip. Otherwise, I mean, I don't really care whether people notice if I repeat a joke, but I don't want to bore myself.
Ah. That's a good advice for yourself, and probably most artists would follow that. And then Rudy Park has a very different flavor, a main character who's kind of... As the dot-com bubble bursts, if that's how they put it, I mean, he's kind of left sort of trying to put his life back together again. So a main character who's tasted some adversity, but it doesn't feel at all like the same canvas as Canderville.
No, it's a lot more lighthearted. It helps that it was created by someone else. It used to be a collaboration between me and Matt Richtel. Best-selling author, and he's a journalist for the New York Times. He came up with the character. I was drawing editorial cartoons for the Oakland Tribune and the San Francisco Chronicle at the time, and he was working at the Tribune. He saw one of my cartoons come in, and he called me up and asked if I could help him develop this strip. So it started off as, it's not purely me. And when he stepped away from the strip 3 or 4 years ago, these characters had taken on a life of their own. They have this distinct voice that is part him and part me. And, you know, I worried, was I going to be able to carry that on? But I wasn't, because as Jan was saying, these characters kind of become real.
And they have their own destiny, in a sense. And you are as much guided by that as you are guiding them.
Yeah.
Yeah, very well put. Finally, Mark Tutuli, let's talk about, let's begin with this pantomime strip called Leo. I don't think it's utterly unprecedented, but it's certainly uncommon on the comic strip page today. Once upon a time, were those kind of comic strips more prevalent, where there was very little, if any, dialogue?
Yeah, back in the 50s, there were a lot of them. There were like Ferdinand and Henry. Those were the first kind of strips that I read, because I didn't have to read them. And they were the first ones that I got. You know, I loved all comics because I just loved the different styles of illustration, but I didn't know what was going on in them. And those were the ones I could actually follow, because the pictures told the story. It's still writing, but it's just all in pictures.
Right. So, of course, I'm sure a lot of our listeners have seen Leo. I know it's in one of our local papers. I don't remember off the top of my head.
Kenosha.
Is it?
Yeah.
Kenosha News.
Yeah.
So we have this little boy, this very imaginative boy, and his father. And it's pretty much those two characters. And there's no mom. I think the mom has died.
That's correct.
But
yeah.
I don't ever remember seeing that. I mean, was that ever indicated in the strip somehow, or is that just something that we just all sort of collectively know to be true?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, again, this goes back to a Disney thing. You know, you always had the single parent and the child, and to me that was interesting because you didn't have the dynamic of two parents trying to keep the kid in line. So when you have a parent and a kid, they tend to be more pals, even though one's more authoritative. And I kind of like that. I had the same thing. I have that dynamic kind of in the Heart of the City strip. Her mother is a single mother. What was the question again? I lost my own thought.
Yeah, that's right. No, I just wondered if you ever tell us in the strip actually what happened to Leo's mom, or
yes,
we just sort of know.
I got so many queries about where's Leo's mom? What happened to Leo's mom? Where is she? Dead? Are they divorced? What's going on? And finally, I wrote a segment where it was Christmas time, And Leo was going through a list of things to buy for his, you know, the different people in his life. And for his dad, he got a bottle of booze. For his squid, he bought mittens. You know, of course, he had to buy 8 mittens. And on his list was mom. And then he goes and buys flowers. And in the last panel, he's bringing it to her grave.
Oh.
And that was like the one single strip that I just got such a huge response from. Wow. I didn't expect it. I mean, people, I also didn't expect it, that kind of thing from the kind of strip I have, which generally goes dark.
Right.
And then it got sentimental, and it was like, it was interesting for me because it opened up a very emotional aspect. Again, it was that Disney thing, you know?
Yeah.
It's embedded in me, and to me it made the character and his relationship with his mom very real.
Very good. I wanted to mention too about Heart of the City, which is Heart is the first name of this little girl with this extravagant imagination, and she's all gives her single mom all that she can handle, but it's a very loving relationship. My introduction to that came accidentally. I was in a bookstore, and I thought I'd grabbed one cartoon collection, and well, among other books I was buying, and I got to the cash register, and it was this book from a strip called Heart of the City, which I'd never even heard of, but I didn't want to go all the way back to the shelves, and I thought, well, okay. So I went ahead and bought it. I'm so glad I did.
That's how actually all of the books were purchased.
Complete accidents. You
yeah. No, I just glued them to other books.
Okay. All right. Well, that was pretty sneaky. Well, it worked for me. It worked for me. For those of you just joining us, we have 6 talented artists in the studio, all in town for the 5th annual Kenosha Festival of Cartooning. We've just talked to the 3 comic strip artists specifically who are in the room, Jan Elliott for Stone Soup, Darren Bell with Canterville and Rudy Park, and Mark Tatulli with Leo and Heart of the City. And now I want to talk to the other artists who are in the room who engage in slightly different artistic pursuits, but no less interesting. I want to start with Mark Anderson, who creates a whole series of cartoons that collectively you call Andertoons, right?
Yeah, what I do is, the kind of cartoon I do is called by cartoonists a gag cartoon. It's a single panel. It's something like you would see in The New Yorker, or if you took like the box off the far side. It's basically a one picture and then the caption underneath, and there's no recurring characters, there's no recurring anything. Every day you start from scratch and you go, what's this going to be? Who are these people? What are they talking about? And sometimes it's business. Sometimes it's in a hospital. Sometimes it's in space. You never quite know where you're going
to
go.
Right. That's one of the things I was most anxious to ask you about is, I mean, Jan Elliott sitting right next to you, she has these vibrant characters. And as she kind of said, their lives sort of perpetuate what happens, not to make it sound like it's easy what you do. But on the other hand, it's like someone else is sort of moving your hand as you create what happens next. But you're really literally starting with a blank panel in a mm-hmm. way that these comic strip artists aren't, because at least they're starting with a certain universe of characters. So is that liberating and freeing, or is that more terrifying?
It is scary, but because you're always like, well, like, who's it going to be? What are they going to talk about? Where is it? Like, what's the joke? But it's very freeing in that I can talk about anything. If I just did, you know, a bunch of like hospital cartoon jokes for whatever reason that week, like a bunch of medical stuff was funny to me. I do a lot of business stuff because business stuff sells pretty well. So I tend to look for that subject matter more, but yeah, you're always starting from scratch, but it's very nice because anytime anything strikes me as funny, I was listening to the radio last week and it was, I think it was Prairie Home Companion, and the person on there was like, everybody clap along, let's clap. And I was like, I hate that when people do that. and I'm like, you know, every person in that audience is like, oh man. And so the cartoon I did was like a person on stage goes, all right, everybody clap along until you get tired, and then it's kind of awkward, and then you stop, and then some people are still clapping, you think maybe I should keep clapping, and then the song's over and you're like, come on.
So it just springs out of the fascinating life of Mark Anderson.
Yeah, stuff like that occurs to you, and you're like, oh, I get to do that.
One of the things that's intriguing about these kind of cartoons, which we'll see in various magazines, is that
almost without exception, they have nothing directly to do with the article in which they are embedded, correct? Mm-hmm. So you're not writing, creating these cartoons in response to any kind of prompts, then?
You're just
creating these and then setting them free and seeing
They're funny little islands in the middle of all that text.
Yeah, well, which I think a lot of people welcome, and a lot of us...
Relief. That's,
yeah, absolutely, no question about it. I want to make sure you quickly tell us about an interesting feature on your website, which is the possibility of someone having a custom cartoon created.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work?
Well, cartoons are great. They're fun, but they're also like great marketing devices in that no one can ignore a cartoon, so you can use that to your advantage. And they're sort of like this great little marketing Trojan horse, where you can get a message in there about a company or a product or what have you. But as long as it's a cartoon and it's funny, then people are like, oh, I like that. And you can sort of like sneak something past them. You know, an ad, they're like, I don't want to look at that. But a cartoon, everyone's like, oh boy, cartoon.
Yeah, right. And then you hit them with something.
And then I'm like,
Well, I'm looking forward to going back to your website, which is what?
Andertoons.com.
Right, to explore that a little further. Very, very intriguing. Very good. Bill Morrison, you began your professional artistic life as a technical illustrator, and by the time you're done, you're in The Simpsons and Bongo Comics. So that seems like a gigantic leap. Is it not that gigantic?
It's pretty gigantic. Basically, I can't really decide what I want to do when I grow up. So I end up doing I've been fortunate enough to have a lot of opportunities, and I kind of grab them all. So I've never really settled on just one thing. So I've gone from movie advertising to comic books to animation. The technical thing was that was about 2 years at the beginning of my career, like as I mentioned, just coming out of art school. And what I really wanted to be was a comic book artist. I mean, I wanted to draw Batman or Spider-Man. And I've since found I didn't really have the chops for that. I'm more of a funny cartoonist, or what they call a Bigfoot cartoonist.
They do.
Every so often I stray into superheroes. Like with Radioactive Man on The Simpsons.
Right.
But it's always in more of a parody, satirical sort of way.
What's it like to be part of the Simpsons universe, which, of course, is this absolutely extraordinary phenomenon?
It's amazing. Whenever you're doing a job, you sometimes forget how much it means to other people or how famous it is. You know, I've been doing The Simpsons since 1990, so I've traveled to a lot of different countries where you meet a lot of fans, and I've done a lot of conventions here in the United States, and you get long lines of people coming up, and people will tell you, you know, they will sometimes recite their favorite episode line for line, and you just sit there going, I saw that one too, yeah, I remember that. But it sinks into you, like, how much these characters mean to people. And it's really cool to be a part of that, but sometimes you just sort of forget that it's this amazing phenomenon, and, you know, you're just trying to get your job done, trying to meet a deadline.
Right. Well, and how long has it been in business? More than a quarter century,
yeah.
I know.
Yeah, we're going into the 27th season on television, and that's for the half-hour sitcom version of the show, and I had the Tracy Ullman cartoons prior to that.
Right, and of course the spinoff of Futurama that I know you've been involved in, and the comic strip incarnation.
I was the art director on the Futurama show, and that was kind of my foray into animation.
Mm.
I worked on the Simpsons movie a little bit, but most of my time in animation was as the art director on Futurama.
It's fascinating stuff, and how exciting to be part of that. And I know for you, Ed Steckley, you're the Ricinian, the Wisconsin boy in this room.
It's about to get a lot less fascinating.
I doubt that. I mean, for one thing, a couple of different artists have talked about Mad Magazine as one of their inspirations, and that's somebody for whom you've done some drawing, although you were telling me that there are very few people who make their living from Mad Magazine.
Yeah. And people who make their living at Mad Magazine are all very, very old because they've been there forever. You know the fold-ins in the back of Mad?
Yeah.
Everybody knows that? That started in 1955 or so. And it started by a guy named Al Jaffe as a one-shot gag. Because all the expensive magazines had a fold-out, Playboy and National Geographic. I know, I never heard of those either. They have fold-outs. And Al, it was a one-time gag where they do a fold-in to save money. And it was a black-and-white gag. And the next month, the editors came back to Al and said, hey, could you do another one of those? Oh, I don't really know if I would. It was a one-shot gag. And long story short, Al's been doing those since then. Same guy. He's now 93 years old. Lives in the Upper East Side of Manhattan. And he hand paints and draws those same way he did in the 50s. The final product, he can't actually fold in because they're done on illustration board, which is thick. You can't fold it. So he walks it over to the Mad offices or takes a cab and hand delivers it just like he always did, and he hopes that they call him the next month. And they're thinking about making it a regular feature. It's been in the back of every issue since then. What were we talking about?
Yeah, right.
That's called a segue.
Right, right. One of the regular features in your life has been participation in USO tours.
Yep.
And it sounds like this has been a really important thing for you, but I think a lot of us can't quite picture how that happens. I mean, what you and your fellow cartoonists do on these USO tours.
The USO tours with a group that we're members of called the National Cartoonist Society started after World War or during World War II, back when cartoonists were really famous. a couple of these guys got together and started to travel overseas to go entertain troops and just do their part to raise morale during the war. And when the war was over, all these guys went back home to New York, where everybody lived, and they started up a club, which ended up being the National Cartoonist Society, which is obviously still there. But the NCS would send off cartoonists on USO tours every year, up until the end of right around Vietnam. They just kind of stopped happening. And about 8 years ago, 8 or 9 years ago, one of our members, who's a Navy captain, got the idea that we should start up these USO tours again. So the president at the time said, yeah, you want to do that? You organize it. Well, this is the guy that actually did